This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. As you probably know, we build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And this week we're at the Scottish Crannog Centre to see how a new Iron Age village is taking shape, which is due to open in the spring.
Well, that's it. All the Christmas decorations are away, the trees down, all the branches cut off, that kind of thing. The season is over and a happy new year to you. I woke up this morning and I was sitting in the kitchen and I could have sworn blind at 4:30 in the morning that I heard a bird sing outside. We're on the right way. I'm Mark Stevens, sitting across the other side of the fire here at Beechgrove in Aberdeen. Rachel Stewart.
Yeah, happy new year to you. You were saying that you're always a bit sad when the decorations come down.
I hate it. Yeah. I mean, I genuinely hate it. You know?
I love it because suddenly space is restored. Fantastic. Yeah. And actually, this is a great start to our first programme, isn't it, of 2024? Because it's a bit cold, crisp,
slightly,
but dry.
Deep
so
and
fabulous.
Crisp and even. Yeah, well, that's it. The amount of water we've had over the last 2 or 3 weeks has been utterly ludicrous.
Yeah.
There's water coming out of the ground with us in places that I've never seen water before.
No.
It's simply the drains, everything, nothing can cope.
Yeah, we've had incredible weather actually since we were last sitting here. I think was it Wednesday the 27th? I have never seen so much water on the road.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that was the 27th. My mum and dad celebrated their 65th wedding anniversary.
Oh, lovely.
On Christmas Eve, but they had the do on the 27th. Mm. And we had rallies came up from the central belt and made it.
That's
and
good
I have
going.
No idea how.
No. We also had relatives visiting and they weren't able to leave. So with the pleasure of them overnight.
Oh, if the gentle listener could just see your face when you said that.
Sadly,
lovely to have
them. We couldn't get north on the A96 as much as I tried. Let us know what your plans are for 2024 or even just this weekend. Will you be out and about? Get in touch. You can email us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. You can text us 80295 or you can give us a bell 0808 529500.
I was talking to one of my neighbours the other day, Bruce Mackey, who says, kind of problem here, he says, it's since they started naming storms. He says, the weather's got really, really bad since they started naming storms. He says, prior to that, it was just a coarse day.
It's definitely been a coarse day.
So,
my dad was thinking they might be running out of names if it's so many in the last few weeks.
I could think of a few.
Yeah.
It is pretty soggy at the moment. I hope you've been able to get out and about. I made my way to Perthshire earlier this week where the sun shone and Pitlochry was just teeming with tourists.
Really? That's good. I mean, I suppose that might be because the schools are not quite back yet in Scotland, anyway.
Yeah.
I was in Moray and in Banffshire this week as well, and again, massive pools of water and some stretches of the road.
Yeah.
But nice to be out and about, and when the sun's shining, you do think, hey, spring might be coming, you never know.
On that subject, we got a card from Margaret Douglas of Bears Den, who tells us that if you have a forsythia bush in your garden, which I do, I'm going to be doing this, cut off a few twigs and place them in a warm room. In 2 to 3 weeks' time, the twigs will produce their golden flowers as compared to the 2 or 3 months' time it would take to do outside. Bring on spring, Margaret writes in capital letters.
Amen. I couldn't agree with you more, Margaret.
Yeah.
Now, come on, you've all been waiting for it. Our very first mystery sound of 2024. Let's have a wee listen.
I'm not sure.
You're looking a bit quizzical.
I am looking a bit quizzical.
If you think you know,
clearly mechanical.
Yeah, definitely. I actually know what it is, so I'm saying nothing.
Okay.
Out of doors at bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 or give us a call 0808 592 9500.
Would it be the half ton of sheet you had to dry across the Christmas season?
Yeah, I had visitors for 9 nights. I don't know if I've mentioned that before, but that was nine nights.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I don't recall you mentioning that in the slightest. We're rather fond of a squirrel in out of doors, and we're always pleased to hear that on our home turf of Aberdeen, the number of red squirrels is on the rise. However, it is quite difficult to actually pinpoint how many greys versus reds there are in the city. That, however, could be about to change, as Nicole Still of Saving Scotland's Red Squirrels explained to me.
We're at a really pivotal point with the grey squirrel population in Aberdeen. We've been working to remove grey squirrels from Aberdeen since 2009. The council had been working since 2007, and we're at a point now where we're right on the brink of hopefully achieving the first mainland eradication of a grey squirrel population.
This is what's known as an island population in Aberdeen. Explain that.
Yeah, so the grey squirrels in Aberdeen were all introduced in a single introduction event, and that happened in 1971 here in Hazelhead Park, actually, back when it was a zoo. Uh-huh. So there's a story that there was one grey squirrel, and they brought up 10 to 20 additional grey squirrels up from Somerset. Those all quickly escaped on the first night. And all of the grey squirrels in Aberdeen since all stem from that original population. So they're both genetically distinct from the other grey squirrels that we have in Scotland, but they're also geographically distinct. So there are no grey squirrels south of Aberdeen until you get further down towards the Montrose area.
I spoke to the son of the man who'd been the zoo curator at the time, and they said, you know, they were preparing. They knew these animals were coming, that, you know, they'd built a cage. This thing was absolutely bomb-proof. No way the squirrels could get out of it. They put the squirrels into it in the evening, and they got up in the morning, they were gone. Nothing.
Yes, I think there was one left, but we suspect that was the one that was already here.
It was quite happy. It knew the area anyway.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
So how many squirrels have you eradicated so far in the Aberdeen area?
So since the project started, they've removed about 10,000. It's a little hard to estimate. Our records have gotten more precise in the recent years, but we estimate over 10,000 have been removed to date by the team up here.
So essentially you've been trapping them, you're mainly dispatching them and so on. So any idea how many might be left?
So this is what we don't know. It's a really pivotal question for us to hit that eradication point. So we need to understand how many individuals are left, and it'll be really important for us to understand then how many we're removing, because to achieve eradication, we'll need to remove squirrels at a quicker rate than they're reproducing. But at the moment, squirrels are notoriously tricky to count, and that's even trickier when they're at such an exceptionally low density like they are in Aberdeen.
How do you count them? How do you know you're not counting the same animal twice?
So at the moment, we don't. So the team in Aberdeen, they work with a network of volunteers, and we monitor squirrels across the city. We do about 7,000 monitoring checks annually throughout Aberdeen City and Aberdeenshire. And of those, we know how many times we detect a grey squirrel. We also get sightings from the public, which are really crucial for the team. But again, we don't know which squirrels are which. People might be seeing the same squirrel. One squirrel might be going to the same feeder or multiple feeders. So we don't have a set count, but we're about to start a project with the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland's Wild Genes Lab, and we're hopeful that some genetic analysis is going to help us understand how many squirrels we've got left and which ones we're actually detecting at our feeders and in our traps.
How will you get the genetic material in the first place?
So the team are about to hand over about 50 tissue samples over to our partners in Edinburgh at the Wild Genes Lab. They'll then extract the DNA from these. Mm-hmm. And then over the next few months, they'll be putting together a genomic library. That library, they'll then be able to extract different genetic markers, which will then allow us to identify squirrels down to an individual basis. As mentioned earlier, the population is likely to be quite inbred because we know it's over 10,000 and we know it started from around 10. So being able to distinguish those individuals genetically might prove quite a challenge. But if we're able to, we'll know that by next autumn, and that'll be quite a key point in letting us know how many squirrels we've got left.
I've seen squirrel traps in the past, and they I think it was down in Dumfries, Lockerbie. But basically, to get into the food, they had to sort of lift a hatch and stick their heads in. There was sticky tape underneath it, essentially, and small samples of hair were being taken. Is that the genetic material you're talking about?
Yes, yeah, so when we get the markers, that's what we'll be able to tell. So right now we've got the feeder boxes across Aberdeen City and Shire, and we've got the traps that our staff operate. We don't know if the squirrels that we're detecting exactly what these hair samples at our feeder boxes are the same ones that we're capturing in the traps. So the initial genetic analysis will be done with physical tissue samples from trapped squirrels, and then the future analysis down to the individuals will hopefully be identifiable with the hairs.
I have to say, I was being shown this trap by somebody who said, oh, clearly you can see this one is a grey squirrel and this one's a red squirrel. They looked the same to me. They looked identical. I couldn't tell the difference at all.
There are differences between the hairs. So both the shape, when you have them under a microscope, the colour can be quite distinct. Our staff are very practiced eyes at this, so you can give them a piece of sticky tape and usually they can tell right when picking it up from the feeder if they've got a grey squirrel or not.
I maybe should have started off with this question. Why is it important to eradicate grey squirrels?
So grey squirrels are the biggest threat to our native red squirrel population, and one of the wonderful side effects of the grey squirrels that we've removed from Aberdeen has been the return of red squirrels down here into the city centre. Grey squirrels pose a risk both because they outcompete red squirrels, but they also carry the squirrel pox virus, which is lethal to reds but carried asymptomatically through grey squirrels.
What's your gut instinct? Do you think you're going to make it? Do you think you're going to be the first to actually eradicate an entire population on mainland UK?
Our team is an exceptional team up here in Aberdeen.
With and a glint in its eye.
Yes. And I think if we keep our foot on the pedal, I think we can absolutely achieve it. But it requires ongoing support both from our statutory agencies, from project partners, from the incredible volunteers that help carry out the work. But we can definitely see that light at the end of the tunnel. And if we can achieve it, that's going to change how we look at squirrel conservation, not just in the northeast of Scotland and in the Highlands, but throughout the entire country. And that story of reds returning to Aberdeen, it changes the narrative of can we maybe return reds to the rest of Scotland? And all of that will be based on the lessons that we can learn with the project up here in the northeast.
Nicole Still, Programme Manager of Saving Scotland's Red Squirrels. If you think about it, the small remaining population of greys are the survivors. They're the smart ones.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to get harder and harder and harder to actually trap them because they're seriously trap shy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, clever. I think they've done a lot of good work in this project because, I mean, like, I remember, was it a couple of years ago, they were trying to think how they could entice some of the red squirrels out of an area near West Hill, I think, in Aberdeenshire. And they were talking about effectively putting them on a diet, so they were putting out less food for the reds to encourage them to go further afield to find their food. And I think now they're prolific in a lot of areas, aren't they? I think a lot of people see them quite close to the city centre.
Where we are, I think in nearly 30 years, we've only seen squirrels on three separate occasions. Mm-hmm. The trouble is, you know, rural Aberdeenshire, it's on the Buchan Plain, so essentially there's lots of farmland, which means not a lot of hedging,
mm-hmm.
and not a lot of trees. I mean, we're the exception, there's lots of trees round about us, but it's an island, and the squirrels got to cross open ground to get to that
there,
island.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, we saw one and just the trees the other side of the patio, one in the front, and one crossing a sort of local dike. But that's it.
That's it. Were they all reds?
Those were all reds. Yeah. I've never seen a grey in the area.
Yeah, yeah.
We used to get greys in the car park here, but that's, you know, they've long gone.
Yeah. Good news
for them. And for a good reason.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, cast your mind back to June 2021, and you will vividly remember this, because I think you were setting forth on a trip down here at the time. What we're talking about is the dreadful fire which destroyed the iconic Iron Age roundhouse in Loch Tay. The whole building was destroyed in a matter of minutes, and of course that basically ended up putting the future of the popular attraction in doubt. However, since then, work's been taking place to redevelop the Scottish Crannog Centre and create an Iron Age village on the other side of the water. I caught up with director Mike Benson at the new site.
This is a building site, I suppose, and you'll probably, if you were here 2,500 years ago and there was Crannog dwellers building their village, you'd see something very similar. You'd see very similar skills, very similar structures, very similar technologies.
It's taking shape, isn't it? You've got quite a few of the buildings that are, well, they look to me like they're nearing completion.
Yeah, we're just waiting for the thatcher to put the hair a couple of the buildings there. We're going to build 7 of these, and each one will showcase a different skill, different materials, different technologies. So when we open, hopefully on March the 31st, fingers crossed, toes crossed, and everything else, that we have a mild winter, yeah, we'll be ready to go, and we just can't wait for folks to come along and just see what we've been up to.
Let's rewind a little bit, because many people will have visited your old location, but we're actually standing on your new one today, just across Loch Tay. Remind us what happened 2 years ago.
Yeah, so 2 years ago, we had a fire Friday night at 11 o'clock on the 11th of June. I got a call from Rich to tell me the Cranog's on fire, I was in bed. And I said to him, yeah, it's fine, I'll sort it out in the morning. Went back to sleep, and then he rang me back, and I could hear all the sirens going and everything. And by the time I got here, it had gone. It took 6 minutes from start to finish for it to go. So, yeah, it was a difficult time for us all, and we called the staff out about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning and just gathered together and said, you know, we're going to do what the Cranog dwellers would have done. Thank our lucky stars, nobody was hurt. Pack up our stuff and move.
And you had already planned to move, didn't you? You had secured this site. You just hadn't done a lot of the work yet.
Yeah, we'd secured the site, but we thought we were going to just take a couple of years to raise some money, maybe another couple of years through the planning, maybe another couple of years to see what was what. So, yeah, our world turned upside down. But I think on that Saturday morning after the fire, I think it was about lunchtime, and somebody had set up a Just Giving site to support us after the fire, and I think it was over £50,000. And that's lots of people all over the world putting in £5, £10, and that would end up over 100,000. By the time we got to lunchtime, I was thinking, you know what, we might be able to keep going. And then the politicians came and all the support came, and then we just started work on this plan.
Talk me through the plan then, because you're creating something much bigger than you had before, aren't you?
Yeah, so funnily enough, we aren't building a Cranog just now. We're building an Iron Age village, and we'll look to start building the Cranog in the spring. But we were charged with developing something that people would love to come and see and be part of, but we could do relatively quickly. So we haven't done a lot of feasibilities, we haven't done an awful lot of thinking, we probably haven't got everything right, but we've just dived in, and everybody's been brilliant, the planners, the local authorities, everything took its time, everything takes twice as long as you think, but the reality is, as you can see, we're well on the way now. I've aged. I can't say I've enjoyed it. I can't say I've enjoyed it. But hopefully on March the 31st, when we're here and we're hopefully going to have a choir from Glasgow, a refugee choir that's going to be singing about sanctuary and home and feeling safe, and launch the new site, I think then I might just stop and think it hasn't been so bad.
Perhaps the fire has actually given you big opportunities to do things more quickly than you would have liked.
Yeah, you could say it like that. You could. I'll leave it at that.
It is challenging for you as well, because of course you're trying to create all of this using the traditional methods that people 2,500 years ago would have used. I mean, that itself is challenging.
Yeah, and we've probably forgotten more than what we know now over the years. And the other challenge we've set ourselves is that all the materials that we're going to use are within travelling distance of a Cranog dweller. So the timbers are from just up the road, the turf is local, the stone's local, everything is as local as we can be. And in the years to come, the hill behind is Drummond Hill. We're going to take some of that land over and coppice it, so we're growing our own materials for the future. And as you'll see, when we meet the apprentices, we're growing our skills for the future as well.
And you have big ambitions. You want this to be the most sustainable museum in the country.
Yeah, and we aren't quite there yet, but I think sustainability is around the environment. It's about the financial sustainability, as I say, growing the skills, growing the partnerships, and being a place that people want to come along and be part of and enjoy and help shape.
What is it you want people to get out of this once you've reopened here?
I think to be inspired by the Cranog dwellers, to be inspired by the people that are working here now, and to maybe reflect on how we might want to live in the future.
Yeah, what were they like? What was life like?
I think we can romanticise things, and we should, that, you know, there will have been a community where everybody could contribute, everybody would be learning a skill, they were making most of the world around them in a sustainable way. Genuine community, They were trading, and culturally, you'll see within the collection we've got bits of seven-string musical instruments. They weren't living in the Dark Ages, these folks. They were human beings that were able to make the most of the world around them and make most of what was possible.
Yeah, so inspiring individuals. Perhaps you could learn a few lessons from them.
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, absolutely. And that sense of wonder with the world and being curious and, as I say, working together to be part of something bigger than themselves, is rather than be so individual, I think we can learn a bit from that.
Mike Benson of the Scottish Crannog Centre. I don't know, I heard that story before about him sort of pulling the troops together and saying, what would they have done?
Yeah.
We'll have to do the same.
Yeah, we'll have to do the same.
Excellent.
Yeah,
excellent.
It is. It's really good. And it'll be interesting to see if they're able to reopen at the end of March. Fingers crossed they will. They just need a reasonable winter to get there.
And a following wind. Anyway, we'll hear more from the Crannog Centre later in the programme. Coming up, a Broth's answer to the Taj Mahal, and yes, it does exist.
And of course, we've got a mystery sound for you today. Let's have another listen. I said earlier that I'm very familiar with this sound, and you burst out laughing.
Yeah, well, there's no way I can answer that without sticking my head right in the noose, and I'm not doing it.
No, correct. We've got some guesses already.
Oh, it's a good ones here.
Yeah, Annie said, is the sound the engine of the Waverley paddle steamer? Dad was on the Preservation Society, and as a wee girl, I spent many trips standing at the end of the pistons with the engineer.
Kate McDonald, Coat Bridge, says, good morning and a happy new year to you all. Mystery sound this morning sounds like a printing press of some kind. Here's to another year of great outdoor adventures.
Colin from Newton Mearns, hi team, and happy new year to you both. Is the sound a chairlift going round?
At that speed, Colin? Come on. David and Kirkcaldy's things. It might be an old-fashioned grain dresser. I could hear that sound in my sleep.
Ah, good guesses. None of them right. Get in touch, though, if you want to have a guess. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text us 80295, or give us a call 0808 592950.
Is it just me? I mean, that fire is going great guns this morning and none of the heat is heading in this direction.
No, it's certainly not heading towards me. I sometimes get the old waft of smoke.
I just kippered you. Sometimes in out of doors, we get the chance to visit somewhere that's more or less on your doorstep you've never been before. That's what happened when Laura Guthrie went to Arbroath and visited a building that she'd driven past dozens of times without actually realising what it was. Lucy Byatt, director of Hospital Field House, showed around.
We're in Arbroath's Western Cemetery, which is essentially a 19th century cemetery, beautifully maintained by Angus Council, still used, still space in it, so lots of people walk it, bring their dogs here, they come and visit their loved ones. It's a really well-used, beautiful, peaceful cemetery. And at the centre of it is this chapel, which was designed by Patrick Allen Fraser, in memory of his wife, Elizabeth Fraser. When she died in 1873, he bought this piece of land, and when we see photographs of the chapel completed, it's in a bare field, really. And so the cemetery has grown up around the chapel. And by this time, the 1870s, Allen Fraser had completed Hospital Field. He had this coterie of craftsmen around him, people that he'd worked with for many years, so they knew what they expected from each other. He'd paid and supported their training over many years. So this is really a sort of exemplary arts and crafts project. Alan Fraser was close to Dickens. He knew Dickens. He supported some of Dickens's charities. So we know the narrative in Dickens. It's his concern about the poverty that emerged after the Industrial Revolution. They were concerned about writers, artists, craftspeople, how to support the handmade. And here we're standing against this sort of pink sandstone building, local material quarried from local quarries and then handcrafted by local men who've been trained by Patrick Allen, who was born and brought up in Arbroath, but then went off to study at art school in Edinburgh and then in Paris, and then came back when he married Elizabeth, who he was extraordinarily in love with. And so this project emerged out of his sadness for her death and is often called Arbroath's Taj Mahal by local people.
It's an incredibly striking building, and it's very ornately carved on the outside. What was Patrick Allen's role in the town at that time? How was he viewed by the people of Arbroath?
I think he was viewed as a sort of a generous you know, so he got involved. So when there was a big outbreak of cholera, he got involved in finding a new water source, which now we think it was Kepti Pond and the water tower there. So he was absolutely part of the town, that sort of paternalistic, Victorian paternalism. So he gifted this building once complete to the people of Arbroath. Very different kind of sense of ownership to Hospital Field, which he had always expressed as being a place to support artists of the future. So this was about giving a gift to the townspeople of Arbroath. And he was in return given the keys of the town and the silver box, which we have in our collection, which is tooled with an image of the chapel on one side and an image of the abbey on the other. So I think this connection between these two buildings was strong. In the medieval period, there was this extraordinary building, and now, in the 19th century, there was still this idea of adding to the collection of extraordinary places in Angus and in Arbroath in particular.
Well, we're going to have a little look inside. So you said this was built in memory of his wife and her parents, is that right?
Yes, so Elizabeth's mother, Eliza Parrott, and her father, who died when she was a child, the Reverend John Fraser, they were exhumed from Arbroath Abbey and brought to rest here alongside Elizabeth and then eventually Patrick when he died.
Wow, it's really incredible. There's very ornate carved pillars along the sides and a crucifix window up at the top and beautiful ceiling. Lucy, you can probably describe it better than I can.
Well, it's just extraordinarily encrusted with carvings, and because it's not been used very much, and Blythe is going to tell us more of the history of why that might be the case, it's almost as though it was finished, the door was shut and nobody came in. Now, that's not quite the case, but the carvings on the interior are absolutely crisp and very much in the style of the arts and crafts, so about nature, about the flora and fauna of the area. So you can see lots of birds and butterflies and shells and berries and acorns carved into all the carvings. And on the second floor, it's even more, every single crevice. And then it's a very complicated building with little turrets on either side, all with circular stair. So if you call that the back of house, there's even more detail there, where every door handle fits back into its own little slot. And there in the stone, there's accommodation carved for the hinges. So the detail is absolutely extraordinary. Very, very special building of national significance.
And Blythe, at the time when this was built, well, it took quite a few years for it to be finished. You can see why it's very, you know, ornate, as we were just hearing. Was it actually used for anything by the members of the public?
I think Patrick's vision for the place didn't necessarily align with what people in the local community felt a place of worship should be, or what they were used to. As Lucy said, he was sort of working with these principles of the arts and crafts movement. There's a real playfulness in a way to this building. I think it's a great place to bring kids, because you could spend hours looking around for different images. So if you look under the alcove behind us, there's a little bat carved up there. So he was kind of working with this idea of a building which is functional but which is also beautiful. When he gifted it to the town, he gave it as a place of non-denominational worship, which in sort of 19th century, quite staunchly Presbyterian East Coast Scotland, in a small fishing town, was maybe a little more forward-thinking, or maybe not necessarily what the people of the town aligned with their views. So as beautiful as it was, and as much as local crafters were involved in the construction of it, like, you know, all the stone slabs came from a local quarry in Carmiley, you had local stonemasons working on it all, I think it wasn't really as engaged with by members of the town as Patrick would have liked it to be, which is why we hope today to bring more people into it. And because it hasn't been as used, it is just so beautifully preserved. So I think it has a really exciting future ahead of it.
What we're doing now is thinking about how we're restoring it, it is actually in the ownership of Angus Council, how Hospital Field take it back, how the Trust takes it back and raises the money to restore it. It's in very good nick, given that it's not had that much work done to it over the last 150 years, but it does have some quite severe water ingress. So there's quite a bit of work to do, maybe bring a bit of heat in, some bring light in as well. So we're working on a major artist commission to install in the chapel as a light work, so that so that we, because we just thought, what would Alan Fraser do? Would he get some lighting designer to do a few bits of lighting? No, he wouldn't do that. He would ask an artist to think about how to see the interior better. And so we're trying to think as he might have thought.
Lucy Byatt and Blythe Stockdale at the Memorial Chapel in Arbroath's Western Cemetery there. I've never seen it. I'm going to make a point of going there.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. I had a look at some of the interior images of it actually last night. Amazing carvings.
That wee carving of the bat, I was trying to think, it rang a bell. I think it's Dunblane Cathedral. There's one of the choir seats folds up, and underneath there's a carving of a bat.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Well, it looks great. I would love to visit it.
Anyway, coming up, how our seabirds are faring during this wet and stormy weather, and the sad answer is not terribly well. And we'll also be hearing more from the Scottish Cranach Centre.
We've also got a mystery sound for you this morning. Here it is again. The producers just said we've got loads of right answers.
You just skipped out the front door and went, loads right, the tone of disgust.
We need to make it harder.
We do. Denise and Phil and Achille Rothes say, Happy New Year. In our heads, we see today's mystery sound as a Wallace and Gromit-style machine that chops up Christmas trees. Starting our couch to 5K regime today. Well, obviously with a couch, but looking forward to an out-of-doors year listening to our favourite programme.
Oh, very good. Karen in Shetland, who says she's fed up with this wind. Happy New Year to you all. The noise reminds me of a school trip to a paper mill near Aberdeen, which I think is sadly just gone into administration. Yes, I know the one.
Yeah, exactly. Sandy May near Blairgowrie. I'm going to take a huge gamble and guess that it's the sound of the shake table, which is the first part on a potato grading machine. Thanks to all the farmers who cope with an awful potato harvest this year for all your hard work and for putting sensibly priced, good quality, nutritious food on the table in homes throughout the country. Amen to that.
Yeah, nice message from Sandy. Loads of time still to guess. If you want to try outofdoors@bbc.co.uk to get in touch with us, or you can text 80295, or Sky is manning the phones on 0885 92 95 00.
These are general comments, but Lorna says she doesn't need to wait for forsythia as a sign of spring. In her garden in Uddingston, winter jasmine is flowering all along the back fence. They say to me, we'll be here till the daffodils come. They are the same colour.
That's lovely. Keith in Dalgetty Bay says, it's nice to hear the Cranog on. My 16-year-old daughter is doing an apprenticeship with them just now. It's been life-changing for her. We'll actually hear from some of the apprentices a little later in the programme.
You may remember last month we started looking at the proposed bids for Scotland's next national park. All the bids need to be submitted by the end of next month. Now, we've already heard from the two bids coming from the Glen Affric area and the bid from Lough Arbour. Let's turn our attention now to the bid being made by the Tay Forest National Park. Local provost Xander McDade explains the area their proposal covers.
So basically, it's most of northern Perthshire. So it's everything from where northern Perthshire bounders the Cairngorms National Park at Killiecrankie and across to Rannoch Moor, and then it comes down, follows the Perth and Kinross boundary down and comes down to Loch Tay, so it takes in Glen Lyon and meets Loch Lomond and the Trossachs boundary at the end of Loch Tay at Killin, and then it comes down, and currently the proposal is to include Creef and Strathairn and come across, takes in Dunkeld and the area around Dunkeld, and then cuts across towards Blairgowrie. It doesn't take in Blairgowrie, it goes around Blairgowrie and takes in sort of north-eastern Perthshire up in that way, again boundaring the Cairngorms.
Why do you want it to happen?
I think there's a lot of really, really good reasons to have a national park here. From an ecological environmental point of view, it would create one of the largest protected areas in Europe by joining up the three national parks and having continuous protected area, which is quite common in other parts of Europe and is now happening in England, but has not yet happened in Scotland, obviously. For the community point of view, it brings in investment, it brings in ways of managing the excessive visitor numbers we've seen in recent years, which has been a challenge, and the council is currently bearing a lot of the costs around that. So there are a lot of wider benefits from that point of view. It allows us to market and identify the area and actually do things that collectively help us to manage that area for the environment, for the economy as well, but actually it gives us the resources to do that, because we have a lot of the problems that national parks experience. We just don't have the financial resource and backing and recognition that we have those issues and ways of supporting that.
You're not slightly concerned at the fact that Cairngorms is huge, Loch Lomond and Trossachs National Park's not entirely tiny. If you're stuck in the middle, that you might somehow lose your identity.
I don't think so at all, because this area is already quite strongly identified. So a large part of this is Highland Perthshire, but not all of it is Highland Perthshire. Some of it obviously goes beyond Highland Perthshire. But actually, from my point of view, this gives us a very strong identity. It gives visitors a very strong identity. And if you are a tourist, often you will look to go to the nicest parts of any country. Usually that's recognised by national park status. So it gives them a natural way of identifying the place that they're going to. It gives us a way of promoting that. I don't see it as a risk that we'll lose identity. I just think it actually helps us to give us the resources to manage that identity in that space and much more efficiently and better for the environment.
We're standing beside Loch Faskally here, just down from Pitlochry. It's January. It is hoaching, absolutely hoaching with tourists at the moment. It just doesn't stop. It's all year round nowadays. So what are the unique selling points of the area that you want to become a national park? Why are these people here?
Well, I mean, I think the reason they're here is for the outstanding natural beauty, which is the first criteria of any national park. You have to be an area of outstanding natural beauty. And some of the areas that we're proposing to put in, like Rannoch Moor, are internationally recognised as some of the most beautiful parts of the world, not just of the country. And they already have levels of protection. But actually, it comes back to that managing an area cohesively. And actually, one of the things that we've seen in, for example, the Cairngorms National Park is through their tourism management strategies, they are finding ways of pushing the excessive visitor numbers on the west and trying to drive some of them across to the east, so that things through like the Snow Roads project, actually businesses on the east benefit, but it also helps alleviate a lot of the tourism pressures that are being felt on the west side. So by managing an area cohesively, you are actually able to start shifting some of the people to other places that aren't as badly affected and can actually cope with those numbers and want those numbers to help them increase tourism and business on that side. So actually, from that point of view, as you said, Pitlochry, it's absolutely heaving today. It's early January, and actually it doesn't stop anymore, and that's great for the businesses here. But actually, at certain points of the year, it is too much. There is not the infrastructure to cope with it, and actually there are other places that could cope with some of that, and there are ways of us promoting that, pushing that in the right direction as well.
First time I came across you, I think you were convener of the Cairngorms National Park Board. Does that give you not an unfair advantage? It surely must give you an advantage, because you know what a national park's supposed to be doing.
I think it has helped with being able to talk about to people what the benefits are of being a national park. I mean, yeah, I'm a great advocate for national parks. That is not surprising. But it has given me a lot of knowledge about the benefits that can bring, but also the challenges. Because, you know, it's not all a rosy picture. There are always going to be challenges. But actually, from my point of view, that gives us an ability to say, right, we know what the challenges are going to be. How are we going to solve those challenges? How are we going to work with people? And we've been quite clear that actually there's a lot of stakeholders involved in this, and not all of them are going to be delighted if we were to get national park status, but we want to try and bring them along.
Who wouldn't be?
I think there's a lot of concern in the land management community about what does national park status mean. I think in general, a lot of people don't actually know what being in a national park entails. You know, we only have two in Scotland, and actually for the size of the country in terms of geography and from the type of geography we've got, which is, you know, we have so many beautiful protected areas, to be honest, I think there should be more than two. So a lot of people don't know what that means, and our national parks are also relatively young. You know, the Cairngorms just turned 20, Loch Lomond's just a bit older than that. Still fairly new concepts to a lot of people, and understanding of what that means. And a lot of things, like, you know, there's very legitimate concerns about being in a national park might mean high house prices. Well, we already have higher house prices in large sections of the area we're proposing than either of the two national parks. Some of the area we're proposing, Aberfeldy and Rannoch, has the highest second home ownership and short-term let ownership in the UK. So that's already higher than the two national parks, but we don't have the tools to help manage that in the same way sometimes.
So you reckon being a national park would give you the tools to manage those situations?
I think it gives us more tools in the toolbox. I think it critically gives us more resource funded by central government, which allows us to do a lot of the things that we would like to do, but we just don't have the resource to do. You know, the reality is councils are facing severe budget pressures. The councils can't step in to resource a lot of this sort of thing, but would like to. But actually, by recognising that we are an area of outstanding natural beauty, we are attracting huge levels of international visitors, actually that needs national support, and this actually gives us the funding to support managing that.
Xander McDade there, Provost of Perth and Kinross Council.
Yeah, and if you're involved in any of these bids, then do get in touch with us, because we're hoping to visit all of them before the end of next month, so you can get in touch outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
One thing I should have asked him, I was listening to the interview back there just now, because he said, you know, we've already got higher house prices than some of the areas in other national parks and what have you. Could national park status actually make that worse? I don't know. Difficult to see, because I mean, the house prices are eye-watering in parts of Perthshire.
Oh, absolutely, because it is stunning, isn't it?
It is beautiful. Yeah. It's an area that anybody would want to stay
in. Yeah, it is. You know? It is. Yeah, it takes in such gorgeous scenery.
Yeah. Now, look, we were bumping our gums, moaning a bit about the recent weather at the start of the programme. The stormy conditions, and they have been extremely stormy on occasions, have been causing issues for wildlife too, in particular seabirds. Earlier this week, a number of puffins were washed up in Cruden Bay. Now, to tell us more, we're joined by Paul Reynolds from Newark Wildlife Rescue near Ellen, who was called out to the stranding. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Just going to start with an odd question. Are these our puffins? Because this is an odd time of year to be talking about puffins at all.
Yes, I mean, the issue at the moment is with the easterly winds will blow birds over this way from further afield. So, you know, same with our puffins. I suppose they would have been here at one point, but they are getting blown in, which is a problem.
And this is quite unusual, is it?
Yeah, it's unusual at this time of year. I mean, there's lots of seabirds around that are washing up or ending up inland that we wouldn't normally get to enjoy from the coast. And part of it is because of this stormy weather.
These are birds that spend a considerable chunk of their lives at sea. So despite the fact, I mean, okay, it's stormy. Surely they should be able to cope with that. What's the problem here?
With an increase in stormy weather where you have back-to-back storms, it means that the birds do not have a moment to find respite, and it creates all sorts of problematic conditions in the ocean for finding food, as well as all the other issues they're having, of course, with loss of habitat and loss of feeding resources. So with the stormy weather, the birds become weakened, they get blown further and further back to land, and they end up getting caught in the surf and washed up on beaches.
And specifically this rescue operation that you were involved in, only one of the puffins was still alive. How is it now?
Yeah, so the puffin's doing well, actually. It's gaining weight. It's actually self-feeding now as well, which is wonderful. It is looking hopeful for a full recovery and return back to the sea. So we're hopeful. I mean, it's likely this individual became a little bit weak with the sort of back-to-back storm, ended up being washed, stuck in the ocean, unable to sort of fly off again, and then got washed up on the beach. The others, unfortunately, were not lucky enough to still be there when we got there. They'd already passed away. But this individual is looking hopeful.
This is the kind of technical question that keeps me awake at night. I wouldn't know where to go shopping for sand eels. So what do you feed your average puffin on in captivity?
Well, funnily enough, sand eels are indeed part of the diet, yes.
Okay.
We have there's these sort of commercial zoological feeds that are provided by companies that do sort of frozen fish and different resources for zoological collections. As a wildlife rescue, it's incredibly helpful. So we can purchase sand eels and sprats and all sorts of different types of marine feed to ensure that they're eating the correct diet.
So effectively, you've got almost like a sort of bag of seafood medley, but for seabirds.
Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant.
Sounds appetising. You've also got a grey heron in your care as well just now. How is it getting on?
Yes, the grey heron's doing well as well. Another storm victim, quite likely. It was during a very windy and wet evening. It ended up on a sort of road, and I suspect it just got blown down onto the ground and landed a bit funny because there's no major injury. A little bit bruised, a little bit dazed, but it's recovering well.
The fact they can take off at all always astonishes me. You know, they're seriously, they just look so ungainly in that sort of takeoff position.
Yes, they're wonderful birds. Very, very impressive.
Yeah. If people come across an injured bird, or any other animal for that matter, what should they do? I mean, if you're walking down the beach with a dog or something like that, and you start to find a wreck of puffins or something like that, what's the sort of modus operandi? What do?
So my advice always is to call a wildlife rescue. If you're in the northeast, that of course would be ourselves. If you're in other parts of the country, there are different resources available. You can search online for your nearest wildlife rescue, and you've also got the SSPCA as well.
Are you worried that you might see more of this then if we're going to encounter the stormy kind of weather?
I suspect so, and we have to be aware that, you know, one of the consequences of climate change is an increase in this sort of weather. I mean, look how wet it's been over the last few weeks, unseasonably wet. I mean, coupled with the fact that we're in winter, it's already a difficult time of year for wildlife. Back-to-back storms, particularly for seabirds. I mean, historically, there have been storms that have followed this pattern. They can wipe out a huge percentage of a population of seabirds. It's just another pressure on them, and it's worrying. So we're hopeful for better weather over the rest of winter to give them a bit of respite. But otherwise, we'll see more and more seabirds being washed up.
Oh yeah, fingers crossed for better weather. Paul Reynolds, thanks very much for joining us. Paul is, of course, the co-manager of the Newark Wildlife Rescue Centre. Back to the Scottish Curling Centre then at Lough Tay, which, as we mentioned a little earlier, is being rebuilt on a new site following a major fire 2 years ago. Now, an Iron Age village is being created to give people a sense of how people lived 2,500 years ago. And, of course, the construction aims to be authentic. Chas Heath is a traditional carpenter who's been working at the site.
So there are 6 buildings here. And they're all trying to suggest how things may have been done back in that era. It's a fine line.
You don't know exactly how they did it.
You don't know. It's experimental archaeology. There's only some indication of evidence, such as charred rings in post holes, evidence of wattle and woven items within buildings preserved in the peat. And there's not a lot. All we can do is imagine what the climate, the environment, vegetation was like back then, with educated reasoning to work out how things might have been built. I mean, there are things like climatic effects like snow load, wind load, if it was exposed, if it was by the coast, if it was inland, up a hill, all sorts of things would have had an impact. Here we're trying to bring in various different examples of mediums used, such as stone, timber, turf, woven materials, massive timber, as in full round logs. We're not definitely trying to say that we've got it right. And the idea is that these could all be rebuilt.
Yeah, and they would be rebuilt, time. Yeah. Can we walk over to this one and just have a closer look? So this looks like a roundhouse, really. Just describe it for me.
Yep, I think, to be honest, most buildings are going to be circular. We've got one building that's square, rectangular there, which is suggesting a slightly different style. The opportunity of building a village is allowing a much better dedicated space to certain aspects of the Crannog experience. What they had in the previous centre was a space, a lean-to or a smaller space, much more sort of a humble space for textiles, cooking, metalwork, dyeing and that sort of thing. This village is giving the opportunity to not only create a better space for each of those topics, but also to express more through the building structures themselves. This one here is going to be a metalwork space. It's obviously going to have some hot elements inside it, so the less timber the better.
And in this, you've got stone here. Yeah,
it's a stone wall, a horseshoe ring stone wall, a bit like a broch actually. It's got turf capped to the stone wall to create a bed for the ring beam, which is made out of larch. We're using larch because it's the most prevalent wood we can use, which is relatively durable. And if they were alive now and the timber was available, the chances are people would have been using larch back then. So that's how we see it. We're not going for total species accuracy. We haven't got that luxury, actually. And we're putting different timbers in as well. I did mention larch, but we are putting in other timbers that are native, alder, birch, ash, oak, as and when we can. And we're making a note of where we're putting all these timbers because we're also wanting to research the longevity of certain species of timber and monitor their performance over time.
Yeah, because these will not potentially last forever. You will have to at least do maintenance on them.
Yeah, maintenance. I think in an original context, maintenance is very much part of your daily chore. So to think that you can walk away and leave these and just come back to them being exactly the same 10 years later is probably unlikely. But of course, a lot of it's to do with just keeping the roof in good nick.
I mean, it's certainly coming on. Talk me through this structure here, this dome-like structure, which has an amazing view of Loch Tay.
You've been in it, have you?
No.
Do you want to have a look?
Yeah, please.
I believe there's about 5,000 rods of hazel involved in this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There's evidence of this structure. We call it, it's like a beehive, an upturned beehive or basket. It's just made of hazel. The uprights are all hazel as well. And it's been made in stages over a couple of months using shorter stakes that then get pulled in towards the centre at the top. I wasn't involved in this one. A fellow called Hamish was involved, and he had previously been involved in building one of these with Dublin University. And we had the lecturer from Dublin University responsible for that build come over and give some advice as to how this was going to go together.
And this isn't finished, is it?
It's not finished, no. We need to put a hat on it. It needs a thatching. And it'll have a dwarf wall around the edge as well. So the thatch will come down on the outside edge, touch the dwarf wall, kick out and throw the... You want to keep the moisture and the rain away from the structure.
What will you use for the thatch?
Ideally, I think we were going to use heather, but it may have to be reed, just because we have an abundance of reed already here. But heather would suit this shape really well.
The rods, I mean, are amazing.
The rods have been harvested from various parts of Scotland and into Cumbria because there's quite a sudden demand for quite a lot when we got the ball rolling. Purchasing these or getting these from people who run coppices is allowing and maintaining and promoting the creation and management of coppices, to be honest. You know, finding markets for this is great. But this is a result of coppicing.
And you won't be creating a crannog itself until springtime?
That's right. There's too much to do just now, it seems. And there are some fine details still being honed about the access to the new crannog. We're in a different aspect on the loch to where the former site used to be. Back on that site, you could access deeper water quite quickly. Here, we're facing the onshore wind, and we've got a shallow beach. And this has an effect on the dynamics of creating or putting the stakes up for the crannog in the ground, because they need some deep water to float. So I think the resulting crannog will actually have a longer walkway out to it to try and achieve that.
What a brilliant view when you get there.
Great view. And in view of another crannog site, which originally existed, actually. When the water gets low in the summer, you can see the tip of a former crannog site right in line with this building.
Carpenter Chas Heath at the Scottish Crannog Centre there.
Yeah, those hazel rods are amazing. And you'll probably remember a few months ago, back when it was warm and sunny. Do you remember that?
We featured
a woodland down in Fife, uh-huh. Where there's a lot of coppicing. And they uh-huh. used the hazel rods from there in the construction of the dome-like building, which was amazing.
Yeah. The folk who originally built the original crannog on the other side of Loch Tay, Nick Dixon and Barry Andrian, they were going across to an archaeological course, and they had a slot for a media person. Mm-hmm. He says, "We haven't got a media person." He says, "Do you want to be the media person?" I said, "Yeah, fine." There's a place called Falboten on Lake Constance, and what they had there was an entire village. It's what they're building now on the mm-hmm. other side of Loch Tay. But the look of sheer envy in Nick's face. I was like, ooh, we could have this, we could have... But again, fascinating. But, you know, did I pick up right that essentially it's going to be a rolling programme of building?
Yes, it is. So I think the plan just now is that they may rebuild a lot of these structures around every 7 years. Might not be an entire rebuild, so it might just be a big sort of maintenance programme. But that's the plan. They think every 7 years they'll do a big rebuild project.
Yeah. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, sitting here... basically screwing up a face against the smoke at Beechgrove. Rachel Stewart. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, you can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
And don't forget the internationally acclaimed Scotland Outdoors podcast, also available from BBC Sounds. Get in touch, tell us where you listen to the podcast. What Bill Ritchie did off the back of our mystery sound on the 23rd of December, which was a camel.
Of course it was. He says, your recent mystery sound reminded me of a trip I made to Dubai where I acted as consultant to the first cloning of a camel.
Wow.
I worked at the Roslin Institute as an embryologist and was involved in the cloning of Dolly the sheep and a number of other cloned animals.
Bill continues, while at the camel breeding centre near Dubai, I asked if I could have a photo taken with the camels. We went into the camel pen and I stood with my back to the camels. That's your first mistake, Bill, so I could have them in the background. As I stood having my photo taken, one of the camels came quietly up behind me and I felt the camel's breath in my ear and the softest lips nibble my ear. I can tell you it was an event which I will never forget. Many thanks for that image, Bill. Now, we have the sporting results you really want to know. Who won the Kirkwall Bar Games? Now, you might remember, before Christmas, we spoke to a competitor from each side. We're very balanced in this programme, Stephen and Liam. And I can tell you that the Christmas Day men's game was won by the Doonies, and the New Year's Day game was won by the Uppies. So celebrations all round in Kirkwall over the festive period. Now, by a wild coincidence, our postie is from Kirkwall. She was home, saw both matches and what have you, got involved in the melee because she accidentally went round the wrong corner with the kids.
Oh, no.
They were fine. They were absolutely fine. But there was a suggestion, and again, I forget which one it was, the Christmas game or the New Year game. Somebody came out of the house wearing a suit, and apparently was slipped the ball.
Oh.
And they managed to make quite a lot of progress with that. I don't know if it's true or not, but I'd like to think
it was.
It's
a nice story. It's a nice
story. It is a nice story. Anyway, it's time for the mystery sound again. Have a listen. Now, Kenny Brennan has actually got the correct answer to this, which clearly we're not reading out at the moment, but he goes on to say he made a trip back over to Scotland from North Carolina to spend Hogmanay with the family at the East Nuke. Can't imagine a better way to start the new year. Booked the seaside sauna in Ely, had a New Year's dip in the Pit and Wound Pool, visited the Salmon Leap, and I'm now listening in hunkered under the feather duvet here at the Knipperick Hotel outside of Oban with nae worries.
That is ace. I love that, actually. Coincidentally, I also went on a hunt with a friend who is the gamekeeper of Dumfries Estate, officially dubbed the Grey Squirrel Controller. Gave me an in-depth look at what a mammoth undertaking it is, keeping grey numbers in check, and made spotting a wee tufty red squirrel all the more special. Looking forward to spending many mornings with you throughout 2024.
You wouldn't have been in the Tufty Club. Did they have the Tufty Club when you were a kid?
No, because I'm far too young.
That's true.
Yes, that's right.
True. I keep on forgetting. Despite the fact you keep on telling me every week.
We've got some more wrong answers as well. Peter Dunlop in Edinburgh says, is it a leather belt being driven by an electric motor? Don't know what it is driving, but the womp womp is the joint in the belt.
Yes, it's a fantastic answer, Peter, but quite wrong. David John Chadwick and Carl Luke says, good morning, very happy New Year to one and all. My wife Elaine and I visited the Loch Dee Trannog some years before the fire and look forward to visiting the new site when complete. Perthshire has a healthy population of red squirrels and Cairngorm Rangers do take appropriate action if grey squirrels attempt to proliferate in areas where healthy reds are stronger in number. And he finishes by saying, I think the mystery sound is of a mechanised weaving frame. That's what I thought, David. Mm-hmm. But it's not, apparently.
Yep. You've got plenty of time to get in touch if you want. 80295 is the text. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is the email address.
Now, it's nearly 40 years since the Winter Gardens at Scotland Park in Edinburgh were redeveloped.
Yeah, the park itself is owned by the council and has a long and fascinating history, actually. I spoke to Craig Dunlop, the park and green space officer, about how the site has changed over the years to respond to different expectations.
One of the real kind of highlights of Scotland Park is that it's got something for everyone. and it's got something nice to see every time of the year, you know. So it's not a one season wonder, you know, and it's not just catering for the needs of the football teams or catering just for the skaters or catering just for, you know, it's a park for everybody all year round.
We've just come into the winter gardens, and the smell when you come in is amazing. Explain the kind of things you have here.
It's a range of temperate and tropical plants. We have an area that's used for meeting places. We have a fish pond and a number of plants that were donated from the botanic gardens in Edinburgh.
Yeah, and as I say, it's the aroma, isn't it, as soon as you come in here?
Yeah, and it's great smells, and also a lot, it gives people a lot of ideas on kind of plants that they can also grow as pot plants in their own homes.
It's actually 40 years, pretty much, since the Winter Gardens had a sort of major revamp.
Yeah, 40 years ago, we centralised a lot of our nurseries that were dotted around the city and over to the Inch Park. A consequence of that is the nursery at Saucton was redesigned into a more visitor-friendly winter garden.
And has it changed much since then, or is this pretty much how it looked 40 years ago?
It's on the same footprint as it was 40 years ago, but it has changed considerably with the recent investment from the Heritage Lottery funding. It went to more kind of detailed and interest in plant and design with new path layouts and kind of new toilet facilities. The glasshouse itself changed from a perspex structure to a more Victorian style glass structure, which was better for the plants and better for the environment.
How have things changed, or how are things changing in terms of what people want out of their green spaces in cities?
I think there's a few things. I think people, you know, one of the successes of the Heritage Lottery funding that we achieved in the park was the opening up of more public toilets and cafe facility. I think people like to see toilets and cafes in their parks. We have a volunteering strategy. I think people like to get involved in looking after their green space. And I also think that people want to see, although Saucton Park sets itself out as an excellence for horticulture, I think people like to see their green spaces used to create more wildlife-friendly and biodiverse sites now. So in the past, where everything was intensively managed for horticultural appearance, now we are more biodiverse friendly sites, you know, so I think people like to see their sites more ecologically balanced.
And how have you done that here?
By creating a number of zones. So we have the walled garden is more intensively managed for horticulture, and we have a sports area with the park which you could class as a sports zone, and we also have the riverside zone, which is the area that sits alongside the Water Leith. And given the naturalised element of that part of the park, we kind of set that aside for more biodiverse areas of the park, such as the wildflower meadows and fruit trees.
The park itself has got a really fascinating history, going back a long way.
Yes, well, the park has been in Edinburgh's hands since the early 1900s. It was the site of the National Exhibition in 1908. And from that date forward and through the timescale and history of the park, it's kind of evolved through the various challenges that the council have had to adopt to, and also just changing fashions with garden and outdoor spaces.
Mentioning the National Exhibition, it was an eclectic mix of things, wasn't it?
It was. There was a number of sites and features within the park. We had a Senegalese village, there was the haunted house type features, there was all sorts of exhibitions from different countries from around the world were on site within the park over that period.
And it's the kind of thing that you probably couldn't quite imagine seeing here again, is it?
No, I don't think we would experience having I think there was even babies born during the part of the exhibition during Senghuis village, of all places. So yeah, I think there's things that we are glad that we have captured in some of the interpretation and history of the park, but whether you would see that replicated now is debatable.
Craig Dunlop there. And if you want to find out more about the Scottish National Exhibition of 1908, which is fascinating, it sounds like it was an absolute riot, then do look up Friends of Sochton Park, where you will see some fantastic photographs from the time. Hordes of people entering the park. I think they had 3.5 million visitors over the six months that it ran.
I don't know whether it is correct to describe a funeral as being enjoyable, but I was at a very enjoyable funeral between Christmas and New Year. It was a chap I used to work with here, Charlie Allen, and it was held in Methlick. It was largely family-run. It was moving, it was informing, it was enlightening. It was just a really interesting thing to be at, because Charlie was a broadcaster. He worked here in the BBC. He was an economist. He wrote books on the subject. He was a writer. He was a sportsman, a heavy games athlete. All sorts of things. If you would like to hear more about them, Helen's put together a really interesting podcast, which I listened to earlier. This is an extract from the programme, recorded in the early 90s, where Charlie was actually interviewed at his farm. That's another thing I forgot to mention. He was also a farmer. His farm was called Little Lardo, and he was interviewed here by Alan Wright.
My great-great-grandfather came here in the first half of the 19th century. I am now the fifth generation here, and I hope to pass it on to a sixth. And it is very important to me to keep that continuity going. As a young man, I would have said, what nonsense. You know, the farm doesn't pay. It's worth £250,000. Sell it and go off rejoicing. But it would break my heart to do that sort of thing now.
But is it something that comes with middle age, this coming back to your roots and the love of the land and that sort of thing?
Well, I was away being an academic until I was really mid-30s. I decided that I wanted to come back to Little Ardo. But what was really critical was that people of my generation, the young men who had stayed at home on the farm, they were all getting big government grants, putting up big sheds and making their farms terribly modern. And inflation was going on year by year. And the ridiculously expensive shed they put up one year, the next year, looked a bargain, or at least 3 years later it looked a bargain. My old dad was a writer, first and last, really, and he wasn't interested in modernising the place. He didn't build anything at Little Ardo in his time there, so that the farm was getting more and more old-fashioned. And at that time, there was a horrendous problem in passing land from one generation to the other because of death duties. But I thought that if the farm was to stay in the family, first of all, we ought to be getting on with modernising it, getting some sheds up. I mean, sheds were the big prestige thing, you know, a few great big sheds. And also that we should get on with the business of my buying my father out so that it would be possible to keep the farm in the family.
Often I get him teared, well, the boss had a clue. He couldn't back a tractor, careful, there was no way he could blow.
Well, of course, I was brought up on the farms in Aberdeenshire when it was still part of the living culture of the farms, and I learned a lot of my early folk songs in the farm kitchen, my granny's farm kitchen, and round the close on the farm, so that it started very early. Really, as regards getting up on a stage and entertaining people, that's much more recent. I think, really, if it started anywhere, it was when I was asked to do an after-dinner speech in England, and it was a long drive down. There were three of us in the car, and we composed this song, The Blue-Grey Coo, on the way down to this after-dinner speech. So instead of making the after-dinner speech, I just sang this song. And I think that was really the start of it. The song went down very well with the Galloway breeders, who saw it as a good advert for their product, or one of their products. And I think really that's what got me into the folk singing thing. I enjoy it. I may say I'd like to do more if I could.
In the old days on the farm, life was hard. but at least there were plenty of folk about. In the warm summer evenings, there were games and athletics, and many a long winter evening was spent in the bothy, singing songs and telling stories. Bothy nights.
The first time I recorded a collection of these songs, it was because I thought that the very rich heritage of folk songs in my area hadn't been recorded in a way that I would like to have them recorded, which I think, you know, should just be a very simple presentation in which the words are terribly important. As regards the songs I've written, I mean, I think I am actually quite proud of the fact that I have been able to add a little bit to the story of the development of our area with songs like The Blue Grey Coo and Lonely in the Bothy, which tells about how the farm servants who used to have lots of pals on the farm are now isolated.
And the mooses, they choke in out the nut holes in the floor, but that's nae the worst of being here, discomforts I can. It's lonely at night in the morning.
And you came back to the farm in 1973, I think. This was to go full-time farming.
It's a while ago now, but yes, it certainly was full-time farming. I mean, 16 hours a day, I would say. I had very ambitious plans for the farm. I was going to have a tremendous number of sheds put up, and I was going to have intensive bull beef, you know, at the press of a button. I was going to be able to lie in my bed and press the right buttons and all these bull beefers would be fed, and I was going to have the greatest herd of pedigree cattle. I imported 7 different breeds from Europe, and I called it Charlie's Safari Park at one stage. Tremendous amount of money got spent. We had 700 cattle here, you know, on 250 acres at one stage. But the thing that I can't say we didn't notice it, but it seemed to creep up awful quickly, was a thing called the overdraft. And just when this overdraft was getting to a critical stage, my dad decided that he would be better to get the hell out of it. So we had a negotiation in which I tried to give him as much as possible and he tried to take as little as possible. And eventually, he went off to a well-earned retirement in Lincoln and left me with a colossal overdraft. Now, the sums might have worked out at the 10% that we did the sums at, but no sooner had the money been paid and the interest rate went up to, well, the highest we got to was 22.5%. And so my farming career from then onwards became slightly difficult. And my ambitious plans, well, were somewhat reversed. I had to get rid of some of these 700 cattle to bring the overdraft down. And I'm afraid to say that really the story of my farming on Little Ardo, since that high point of, well, we had 3 men working and 700 coos, and the masons were here building stuff all the time, has been one of retrenchment and trying to get the overdraft paid off, the farm secured for another generation, and to get into the position to hand it on in good heart, but not highly stocked, to another generation.
Charlie Allen there, former BBC Radio Scotland presenter and lad of Perts, who died recently. And they carried Charlie at the kirk, you know, in Methlick, and they go down a slight slope into the old cemetery and what have you. And it's just beside the River Nithen. And the piper played, and there was a couple of buzzards scurrying just over the Scots Pines, the other side of the river and what have you. It was just a lovely, lovely funeral.
Yeah, it sounds it. And the podcast that Helen's put together is well worth a listen.
He tells
some fabulous stories, master storyteller. The story at the end is very funny and illustrates the sort of dry northeast wit of the farming community really well.
Very, very dry. I said that latest edition of Scotland Outdoors podcast is available now on BBC Sounds.
Now, back to the Scottish Crannog Centre, and the work to create a new Iron Age village has provided a unique opportunity for those who are interested in experimental archaeology. The structures are being erected by hand, as you'd expect, using ancient techniques that can involve a bit of trial and error. I spoke to some of the apprentices involved in the construction, including green woodworker Toby Sloan.
When I was going to leave secondary school, my careers advisor suggested that I join the Crannog, and I'm very glad that I did.
What is it about it that appeals to you?
It's, on one hand, preserving the, of course, the artefacts is a big part of it, and preserving kind of the heritage, and preserving the lives of these people that lived 2,500 years ago. Then on the other hand, getting involved with the practical side and the crafts, and helping build the Lurb.
Some of the practical work's just going on beside us just now. What kind of things have you been doing?
Well, today we've been adding some more pegs on top of the one of the roundhouses, going to be the metal working shelter. And the pegs are to kind of secure it and then also to kind of hold the turf that's going to go on top of that.
These are all using very traditional skills. Has that been quite a steep learning curve?
It's definitely very different. Yeah, not breaking out the power tools. It's very interesting work, though. It's good to be kind of more in tune with how they would have done it 2,500 years ago.
Explain what you're doing just now.
So I'm just making a hammer here. So we just found this nice handle and a piece here, so I believe we're going to wedge it together.
You're just shaving lots off so that I suppose you're making a more pointed end.
Just getting it to an inch, you see, so you get that diameter there so we can slot it in. Then we'll basically just saw down the middle and we'll actually put a wedge so it kind of opens up.
Tell me what your name is.
Yes, I'm Ralph McFadden, yes.
And how did you come to be here?
Just seemed interesting. So I did an apprenticeship in customer service for the first year, and then working on to the greenwood working, and also museums and galleries apprenticeship I'm doing as well.
So what kind of things have you been doing when you've been here?
Oh, all sorts of different stuff, almost tours as well, at the old site, and then obviously for the greenwood working, more sort of here at the Lurb, just making the all the structures and everything.
You've obviously got a real interest in working with wood. Have you been learning a lot?
Absolutely, yes. Just sort of picking up all the basics and then sort of, obviously, the more sort of timber framing and everything. We would have finished our turf. Well, that's going to have to get redone, actually. But
why is that?
I think it didn't have the support, sadly, so it's getting a little bit droopy. But we'll just fix that, I believe. Yes.
And is that something that you have to do? You're going to have to learn as you
yes.
go and sometimes do things
again? Very much a learning curve, yes. Just seeing how we could do it differently and better as well, yes. But just nice to be making things. Using our hands.
My name is Kat Hotchkiss and I am the Building Vernacular Crafts Fellow for the Crannog Centre, but I'm employed by HESS, Historic Environment Scotland.
So what is it that you're doing here? Are you overseeing some of this work?
I'm not sure if I'd use the word overseeing. I'm learning, so I'm here to learn about different local vernacular crafts that would have been used in the Iron Age construction of domestic buildings like the ones that we're building at the moment in the Iron Age village, and then later the actual Crannog, which will be on the water.
So tell me about some of those crafts.
So building walls with stones, I'm learning stone diking, and then we've got woodwork, which I've been doing for the last few months, and that's looking at timber framing, round timber rafters for the roof, yeah, crux framing, things like that. Thatching, reed thatching, which maybe isn't... We're trying to use the materials which are accurate to what's available now, but they're not exactly the same materials as were available 2,500 years ago. So we're also going to be using heather, thatching the roofs, and turf roofing is another method that we're looking at the moment. There's an amazing wealth of knowledge that people will have built up over generations of perfecting using materials that were available to them, and we're not even at the beginning of reconnecting with those skills. It's all really quite experimental at the moment, figuring out how to best structure buildings. Prehistory is prehistory because we don't have a lot of information about what buildings would have been like exactly. We're using archaeological remains to read how the structures would have been constructed. So looking at the past to inform craft.
There is no manual. You are having to make your own judgments and I suppose sometimes learn from your mistakes.
Oh yeah, lots of learning from mistakes. Yeah, it's what's the right size of timbers, you know, what the right type of timber is, you know, is birch harder to drill through? Larch is great because it's more weather resistant. It would have been warmer back 2,500 years ago, and now it's pretty dreek, as you can tell. So yeah, it's learning from experimenting, figuring out what works, and then these buildings should be recreated, rebuilt every 7 years. So every time we're constructing them and reconstructing them, we'll be tweaking what our craft people and what our archaeologists and what our architects and engineers have learned on the, along the process.
You get more out of it than just what the thing will look like at the end.
Yeah, there's an interesting idea around phenomenological archaeology, which is thinking about not just how the world would have looked or how buildings would have looked, but how the building site would have sounded, how the world would have sounded, how it would have smelled, how it would have felt. And by creating things with historic techniques and historic tools, you begin to hear and feel those, or be able to empathise with those sounds and smells and sights. So you get this beautiful smell of oak when you're cutting the dowels. You get the turf, the earthy turf, when you're picking it up and handling it. Yeah, it's all quite sensory overload.
Toby Sloan, Ralph McFadden and Kat Hotchkiss there. And best of luck to them. I hope they manage to make their opening date.
Absolutely. In fact, we might even turn up and add to their stress.
Yeah, absolutely. Just make life even more difficult for them.
Yeah. They're actually going to create the crannog that will sit in the water in the springtime if they get good weather. So it's still to come. So it'll be definitely worth seeing.
Anyway, time now to reveal our mystery sound for this week. Let's have a final listen to it for a start.
I think this was quite easy because, you know, it's a sound that I'm very familiar with. I'm
always
in my garage on it.
Well, it turns out it was a treadmill.
Yes, apparently it's a treadmill.
Yeah, I thought it was a weaving machine for a start and what have you. And Gordon and Maureen from Nethybrood says, is the mystery sound Mark trying to lose some weight in the treadmill? Why would that be now, Gordon and Maureen? Why would I need to do that?
Billy Vitale says, mystery sound is a very grumpy me standing in the gym wondering how long it will be until all these people I've never seen before give up their New Year's resolutions.
End of January. Traditionally, that's it.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. If you even reach the end of January.
Mm. Kirsten from Starbridge, West Midlands, says, running machine, probably trying to shed weight after the Christmas indulgence. Colin S. in Glasgow says, sounds like someone in a running machine is part of their New Year resolution. A bit early for that, in my honest opinion.
Yeah, I like it. Stuart Taylor and Elgin, Happy New Year. It's a gym treadmill. The Kerr family on the way to Edinburgh from Fern and Easter Ross. It's the dreaded treadmill, yeah.
But this week's Anorak Award goes to Anthony from the Isle of Skye, who says, is the mystery sound someone running on a treadmill running machine? Fairly sure it's a power jog machine. Spent hours on those, thanks to a good programme.
Richard and Mandy in Exeter, we think today's mystery sound is Rachel on her treadmill, getting rid of her disappointment after her guests finally left after 9 happy days.
Yeah, yeah. That must have been difficult waving them goodbye and trying not to laugh out loud. But never mind. Anyway, that's it for this week. Don't forget our new Scotland Outdoors podcast, available today at noon. And on Wednesday, our midweek podcast features a herbologist, Catherine Conway Payne. From all of the team here, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I hear you think podcasts are all about true crime, huh? Well, wise guy, the iHeartRadio app's got all kinds of podcasts. We got stuff you should know and stuff they don't want you to know. We got Bobby Bones, Big Boy, and Lou Later. We got SpongeBob Binge Pants and Exotic Erotic Storytime. We got Doughboys, Two Dudes in a Kitchen, Green Eggs and Dan. Hey, we got ElfQuest. We got podcasts for everything on the iHeartRadio app for free. If you don't download that, well, that's not just a true crime, my friend. That's criminal.